I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Veterans Day. Today we have stories to come about an Iraq War veteran who's traveling the world on a poetry scholarship. He's finding himself drawn to the scenes of other battles. Another veteran wants to return to Iraq, this time with the shovel of a farmer, as he says, instead of the sword of a soldier. We'll have those stories for you. But first, an issue that affects America's troops and has come into focus following the murders at Fort Hood. How to deal with the information that's come out about the suspect, Major Nidal Hassan, specifically his Muslim faith. Critics on the right have long said there's too much political correctness around exploring whether a person's interpretation of their Muslim faith might be a factor in violence. Yesterday, we heard from NPR's Daniel Swerdling that Hassan's colleagues at Walter Reed Hospital told him, Daniel, they wanted to fire Hassan, but asked, how would that look? There are so few Muslims. Well, now we're hearing from respected military writer Thomas Ricks, who asks, was he not let go for fear of prejudice? And if so, is there anything that can be done differently? Tom Ricks is going to join us in just a few minutes, but we start today with Dorothy Rabinowitz, a well-known voice from the Wall Street Journal op-ed pages and a member of their editorial board. Dorothy, welcome.
Thank you.
And you are one that says there is far too much hesitancy around pointing to Hassan's faith, especially in the early days after the shooting. You say you saw an obvious connection.
Yes, of course there was. But, you know, I am, in this case, this is a very large event. This is a singular event that has brought people together. It is, to use the old phrase, it is a true wake-up call, because people on all sides of the political spectrum have been shaken into the awareness that we have been paralyzed by fear in this way. And I wonder what Muslims serving in the armed forces must feel about being treated like some delicate flowers who cannot live through any mention of Muslim faith of someone who does these things. I mean, this is another way of isolating them. The point is, there was an effort on the part of the media, who apparently still live in an alternate universe, to say that the motive for these killings was unknown, which is very hard to fathom. The motive of a man who jumps on a table to shout "Allahu Akbar" and then pulls out a gun and shoots as many people.
Dorothy, I have to stop you there because, just quickly to say that there were witnesses. There's a survivor who spoke on the Today Show, just picking up on that little fact, and she says she heard something, but she wasn't sure what. So, you know,
what does that mean?
We don't know. We don't know motive.
Wait a minute. Are you saying we don't know that he said "Allahu Akbar"?
Well, there are some who say they're not sure, and there are some who say you can't know motive until you've spoken to him.
Well, what are we to say about this? If you get up on a table to shoot people, if you have compiled a considerable record of virulent anti-American statements, you know that there's a long and very obvious assortment of proofs that his detestation of the war, his insistence, his plea, his hour-long rant asking that Muslims be exempt from the army, which, by the way, is a volunteer army.
Okay, hold up one more second. You've made several points. And more people are coming to your thinking as more information comes out that Hassan's roots need to be better explored and that there's a lot of gaps here and they need to be filled. But I just want to ask, in the first aftermath of the shooting, can you see why the Army felt they needed to be more careful? Hundreds of innocent, as you said, Muslim troops on the base, angry soldiers. And as blogger E.J. Esko writes, at that point, Hassan is no different from a soldier who killed 23 people at a cafeteria in 1991 with, you know, no sense of his motive.
Well, why should anybody, with the exception of the fact that it was instantly clear, not 2 days later, that this particular man, who with a Muslim name, had in fact been the subject of scrutiny over things he had said and done. These things came out very quickly. What was really fascinating was the degree to which this entire story was, you know, the attempt to vitiate the meaning of this event as the crazed U.S. serviceman. I mean, this picture of American soldiers as prone to mental illness is really a fantastic, you know, assault on reality.
Well, what do you think the effect of, in your opinion, not addressing what we now know far more clearly than we did Friday or Saturday, what we now know far more clearly is a trail of real concern about Major Hassan? What do you think the effect of that is, not having tied that together.
Well, of course, it is to confirm what people concern. There are lone jihadists. They don't have to be connected to al-Qaeda. There are people who are in the thrall of paranoia. There is an immense loathing. What should people think is very difficult to say, but people know 2 and 2 equals 4, and the effort to say that 2 and 2 equals 6 or 12 or 10 on these theories that ranging on everything for the search for motive, even as 13 men lay drenched in blood and scores of others were wounded, to be concerned that we haven't yet found the right word for Major San, who was clearly out to butcher American servicemen penned up in a room in the most helpless of circumstances.
But there's also been ties between him and any organized group.
That's right, and exactly right. We do not need to ascertain that you have to have an organized group to do this.
Well,
you can be in the thrall of thinking like a jihadi, acting like a jihadi, and in the deep belief that the entire Christian, Jewish, and other infidel world is your enemy, which is what apparently that this is the man who said regularly to his colleagues, I am a Muslim first and an American second.
Well, your newspaper is editorialized. You wrote on the op-ed page, but the editorial, and you're on the editorial board, said that the U.S. must have Muslims in the military. Here's the quote. We can't pretend that we can field a military that doesn't include Muslims. In Iraq, devout Muslims worked loyally as translators, sometimes dying to rid Iraq of their common enemy, homicidal Islamic forces. So what to do.
Well, that is exactly right.
But what to do about...
There are things that simply cannot be programmed. The first and foremost concern we should have is to preserve the lives and safety of targets of individuals like this.
But by doing what? Should Muslims not be allowed in the military? Should they be tracked?
No, this cannot be done. I mean, you cannot exclude Muslims from the military. Nor should you. But you have to be able to free yourself. You know, the 9/11 hijackers who escaped every considerable suspicion because people at the airlines counters and higher officials were afraid to stop them. They were afraid to say, you don't have picture ID. Can you get on an airplane without picture ID? Not easily, but they could because they were young Muslim men. That is the distorted thinking, the elastic.
Well, actually, back then, just about everybody was getting on. But, Dorothy, I'm going to hold you up there. You have made your point.
Okay.
And we really appreciate having you on. That's Dorothy Rabinowitz of the editorial board of The Wall Street Journal. Dorothy, thank you.
You're very welcome. Bye.
Bye. Let's bring in Thomas Ricks, longtime military reporter, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, where he writes the blog The Best Defense. Tom, this, I know, these are words that you've been hearing. Why are we so afraid? And columnists even writing, did political incorrectness lead to Fort Hood? Your first thoughts on that?
First thoughts, as I listen to Dorothy Rabinowitz, she paints it with a very broad brush. And man, do I envy her absolute certainty. She seems to absolutely be certain that she's right. I think a little bit of doubt here is helpful. That said, there's no question in my mind that the shooter was crazy, but he was also a Muslim, and he was also a terrorist. So he's a crazy Muslim terrorist.
And terrorist because he targeted Americans. I mean, how do you define terrorist? One definition that we've seen recently is that it's a terrorist was supposedly when you targeted civilians.
No, a mass killing of unarmed soldiers who are not in a combat situation, who are lined up in a room, that to me, that's a terrorist act. Yeah. Why didn't the Army do a better job of detecting this? Yes, part of it, I think, is a wariness of engaging in witch hunts. I think the Army bends over backwards to be careful about this, and they should. But also, the Army had kind of a blind spot here. They're very good at policing extremism in the enlisted ranks, looking for white supremacists, for Nazis, stopping soldiers who engage in that sort of stuff. What they're not so good at is looking at officers. They're not accustomed to that. And especially with doctors who are treated as kind of a special case in the military, they're expensive to get, they're hard to get, and they're, you can see from even civilians who have watched the TV show MASH, these guys aren't treated like real officers. They're kind of specialized people who are supposed to have specialized skills.
Well, you've put out 5 basic questions on your blog. You've been wrestling with this topic quite a bit. And one of the questions is, he was obviously a low performer. Let's start there. As a psychiatrist, he was shuffled along through the system again. We heard from Daniel Zwirling that he was completely incompetent. And you ask, how did that happen? Columnist Ralph Peters is writing, remember, this is a psychiatrist who was sent to treat our mentally wounded veterans. How did that happen?
That's an important question, because this is a question of leadership, of taking care of your soldiers, which is the duty, the explicit duty of commanders.
But is the
whoever shuffled this guy along, who let this nut counsel wounded soldiers, did not do the Army or those soldiers any service.
But was he allowed to move along? And this is another one of your questions, for fear of appearing prejudiced. Again, we hear reports that his colleagues at Walter Reed sat down in a meeting and said, how would that look, one of our few Muslims?
Why that happened, we don't know. But clearly there's a pattern in the military of shuffling along low performers, of stuffing them in little corners, and especially of dumping them on other units. That's one of the things I think we really would like to know. There was a book on this guy, Walter Reed. They knew he stunk in a variety of ways. When he was sent off to Fort Hood, what did the receiving unit know about him? I suspect they figured it out pretty quickly, especially if it looks like this guy was just doing paperwork at Fort Hood. They were just going to keep him in a corner until they could get rid of him quietly.
Well, but even then, you raise other questions. If he was ranting instead of practicing medicine, telling one patient, I can convert you, that will save your soul. If there was this book, how come when a defense investigator is investigating emails that he sent to a known violent imam who's now in Yemen, why wasn't there some alarm that went off that connected the complaints at Walter Reed to that investigation just earlier this year?
That is exactly the question. I think we don't know. We should know. And I worry when the Army says, oh, let's not have a backlash, which is what the General Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, said last weekend. That's a bit of move along here, nothing to see here. That there was a failure here on the part of the Army that I think does need to be probed. It's rather painful for the Army. They don't want to do it publicly, but I think they need to. And I think they owe it to not only those who were killed, but also those who are in the ranks today, the hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and especially to the Muslim soldiers, who the other people need to know that they're being protected, and that, you know, the soldier next to them, Muslim, but he's a good soldier.
As you say, that's one way to prevent a backlash. That's longtime military reporter Thomas Ricks, author of Fiasco, also senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. When we come back, Tom, I want to ask, how do you do this? How do you find who those people are who are extremists of any faith and not violate rights that these same soldiers are fighting for? We're going to be back with more from Tom Ricks in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We have a couple more minutes with Thomas Ricks, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, also an editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, a blog going there. And we're talking about whether or not the media, maybe the military, are too politically correct in addressing Major Nidal Hassan's faith, his Muslim faith. And Tom, you conclude in your blog that something has to be done to prevent a backlash against Muslims, but also to convince troops that they are working side to side with people who support them. I wanted to just throw out that, you know, maybe the military has done a pretty good job of this. This is one event here in the U.S. But one of your colleagues at Foreign Policy, Mark Lynch, he rejects what he says is the emerging narrative about political correctness leading to this tragedy. He says the real danger is that we're getting drawn into a clash of civilizations narrative, you know, that if we make it about Muslim faith, then we are fulfilling al-Qaeda's pledge that this is a clash between civilizations. Is that a tricky walk there?
No, and I reject Mark Lynch's argument. I think he's an interesting guy, and I like reading his blog. I think he's wrong in this case, because this is not a witch hunt. This is a guy who was in communication with a violently anti-American cleric in Yemen.
Although we got to jump in to say that those emails were supposed to be completely innocent, asking about how Muslims would react in war, and he was doing a speech on the same thing. Yeah.
Give me a break.
Okay.
He's sending, this is a guy who, after the shooter killed those people, said it was a heroic act. You know, this there were warning signs here. And so the clear, bright line to me is you should assume that a Muslim soldier is a good soldier unless there's evidence of the contrary. In this case, there was evidence on the contrary that wasn't acted on.
And how do you keep, what was missing? We just have about a minute. What was missing in keeping that evidence in front of everybody?
Well, I think Dorothy Rabinowitz is dead wrong when she says, look, he detested the war in Iraq, and that was a warning sign. Give me another break. I detest the war in Iraq. I think it's the biggest mistake in the history of American foreign policy. That does not make me a terrorist. It shouldn't even make me suspected of terrorist. It should make me someone who loves my country and worries about its acts. What the warning signs you've got to act on are when somebody has a pattern of aberrational behavior that seems to express sympathy for terrorism, especially when that person then acts on that behavior by communicating with people who are in communication with terrorists.
Thomas Ricks, Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security, Editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. We'll link you to his blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Thomas, we are going to continue reading as you continue to wrestle with this. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, a controversy over political correctness is brewing in the small town of Kent, Connecticut, which lost one of its sons, James Gadiel, just 23, when he was killed on 9/11, working in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. About a year ago, his father, Peter Gadiel, asked Selectwoman Ruth Epstein if she would consider erecting a memorial to his son at Town Hall. She knew his son. She thought it was a wonderful idea. Until Gadiel presented the town with the words he wanted on that memorial. James Gadiel, 1978-2001, a gentleman and a gentleman murdered by Muslim terrorists. Ruth and the select board thought those words were too inflammatory. They tried to talk Gadiel out of the idea but failed. And now their small town disagreement has gone viral with Bill O'Reilly of Fox News championing Gadiel's cause.
The town should give in and should stop the political correct madness. And if we have to charter a bus and go up there, we may have to do that.
I will be
and Kent, Connecticut Selectwoman Ruth Epstein joins us from her home. As you heard, supporters of Peter Gadiel say you're whitewashing what happened to his son, being politically correct. What do you say to that?
We totally disagree. That is not the issue here. Kent is a very warm, welcoming, diverse town. And to put something of that nature would be so hurtful, we just couldn't do it.
Well, you say you have three private schools with a lot of foreign students. You have Muslims who work in or visit Kent. And you also didn't find wording like that on any other 9/11 memorial?
My colleague, Selectman Bruce Adams, looked online, and not one mentioned the word Muslims that we could find.
And it's not that you're not sympathetic. We understand you knew James Gadiel, and we're kind of torn when Peter first asked you about this.
Yes. Who wouldn't have sympathy for Peter and any family who was struck by that horrible time? But our thought is, why not remember James for the lovely young man he was and put something peaceful in honor of him rather than to mark the Muslims on that site?
Well, and his dad points to Holocaust memorials that do, on many occasions, mention the German perpetrators. He says, you know, this is sort of denying history, but you say the memorial's not as much about history as it is about the young man. Yeah. Well, you're getting a lot of response from people outside of town, inside of town. What are you hearing?
I've gotten more than 150 emails, some pretty awful and pretty vile.
Well, in fact, I'm going to jump in. The Hartford Courant is reporting you've gotten emails saying, I hope you and your family are murdered by terrorists.
Yes, and some other horrible things. The ones we've gotten in Kent, the vast majority are in support of our stand.
Well, we're reading in the Hartford Courant a comment from someone on the street who happens to be a former Army reservist. I think he was Kent Veteran of the Year. Mm-hmm. His name is Jerry White, and he agrees with you. He says, using words like murdered by terrorists isn't appropriate. Language like that will inflame Muslims, and Lord knows we've already got too many problems in the world to invite more trouble. It strikes me in hearing his words that what one person would call political correctness is what another person might call wisdom. And what do you do going forward?
The last I heard, Peter said if the wording can't include that phrase, then he doesn't want it at all. So I guess we're at just a standstill now unless he comes forward with something else.
And that would be sad.
Very.
Ruth Epstein, first select woman of the town of Kent, Connecticut. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, taking a look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. The film 2012 is coming to theaters. It's based on a belief that the world will end when the Mayan calendar resets on December 21st, 2012, a long time to turn the page, over 5,000 years. But we'll find out what the Mayans actually believe. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the stories of two veterans of the Iraq War. Their weapons have been forged into pens in one case for writing and shovels for farming in the other. They're later. The very latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The bodies of six British soldiers were killed in Afghanistan were returned home this week. As is the custom now, they passed through the small village of Wootton Bassett, where people line the streets to pay their respects. More than 230 British soldiers have died in Afghanistan, and opinion polls suggest support for the war there eroding as the death toll climbs. The BBC's Naomi Grimley prepared this report.
Just opposite the Houses of Parliament is Westminster Abbey, and here they've actually set aside a patch of grass for a garden of remembrance. There are hundreds of little crosses with poppies pinned to them and the names of the dead, and there's even been a special section that they've laid aside for those who've died in Afghanistan. But you only have to come here to realise just how controversial the war is becoming in Britain. Can I just ask you about your thoughts at this time about the war in Afghanistan? Do you think that British...
Well, I think they should come out.
You really do? Though you're a military man yourself?
Yeah, but we shouldn't be in there. They're never going to win. That's my opinion as an ex-soldier.
Oh, gosh, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I think I'm in two minds, which I wasn't before, I think. I think the events of this week have changed things quite dramatically, I think, for a lot of people.
What about you, madam?
Like my sister, I agree that... Really, the events this week have changed things, and that's why we've come today, to pay our respects to those poor young men and the little children that won't have any daddies when they grow up.
And there are some quite surprising voices echoing the general public's concern about Britain's role in Afghanistan.
Don't know where.
Vera Lynn was the woman who kept morale high in the Second World War with her timeless songs. But earlier this year, even she openly questioned the point of having troops in Helmand province.
I'm sure they don't quite know what they're really dying for, because they're not saving this country at the moment. It's not that near home, so they must question it themselves.
From the Royal Marines, Sergeant Lee Holtram. From the Light Dragoons, Trooper Philip Lawrence. From the Second Royal...
In Parliament itself, it's now become a grim tradition that every Wednesday the Prime Minister reads out the names of those who've died in Afghanistan.
From 40th Regiment Royal Artillery, Lance Bombardier Matt Hatton and Bombardier Greg Hobson.
Until now, the voices of dissent have been relatively rare at Westminster. That's because all the main parties have been bound together in their support for the Afghan mission. But that's beginning to change. Last week, a former Foreign Office Minister, Kim Howells, became the first senior figure to call for a phased withdrawal.
The cliche that politicians come out with, which is we're there for as long as it takes, just won't wash, because we have to be able to explain to the communities that provide the troops there is an end to this, that there's a moment when we know that we've won this. And I'm not sure that that is at all clear at the moment.
A printer's studio in West London is a far cry from Helmand, but it's where former Marine Sean Power is preparing for his new exhibition of war photography.
To the left, this is the troop medic who's always attached when you go out on the ground.
In this digital age, the civilian population has a better idea than ever before about what actually goes on the battlefield. But Sean thinks the modern media is also changing the way the public responds to news of a soldier's death.
It makes it all a lot more personal. His photo would be in
in the newspaper and the next day, a little bit about his career, his history. With that, it definitely makes fighting wars harder.
Others are also wondering out loud whether public opinion is becoming too easily swayed by the numbers of fatalities.
I don't think we as a society understand war.
Professor Richard Holmes is one of Britain's most respected military historians.
We lost, 137 servicemen in our worst year in Northern Ireland in 1 year. You would get a single infantry battalion in either world war losing dead the sorts of numbers that we're now talking about in Afghanistan in a single week. Wounds and death are the currency of war. And if you cannot afford the currency, do not fight wars.
Military historian Richard Holmes, ending that report from the BBC's Naomi Grimley. We'll be back in about 30 seconds, here and now. Brian Turner used to carry a rifle. Now he's armed with a pen. Turner is an Army veteran. He served in Iraq and also in Bosnia-Herzegovina. He's a writer. He contributes to the New York Times veterans blog, Home Fires, and his book of poems about the war in Iraq, called Hear Bullet, won several awards. Well, we highly recommend both the blog and the book, and you can read some of his poems and link to the Home Fires blog at our website. But the book was part of the reason Brian Turner was chosen as the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholar. That's granted him a year to travel anywhere he wants, and that's what he's doing. He joins us from the studios of Sky Radio in Athens, Greece. Brian, tell us more about this Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholarship. What does that mean?
I sort of call it the bad parent award, in the sense that it's like, we love you, but get out of the house. And I joke, but it's an amazing award. I'm very, very happy to get it. Basically, what they do is they give you enough money so that you can survive for a year, and you have to leave North America from Canada down to Panama. Anywhere else in the world, you can do whatever you want.
Well, and you asked in your blog, where should I go? What should I do? Should I dodge pirates off the Malacca Straits, ride a camel beyond the outskirts of Cairo? So what did you decide to do?
Well, the first 4 months, I'm traveling with my fiancée, Elise, and we're traveling in parts of Europe right now. We're going to come back in December. There's an event I have to be at in Los Angeles. Then we're going to go from there to Vietnam. And then once we get to Vietnam, she's going to come back home, and I'll continue on from there for the rest of the year.
And where will you go?
I don't know.
You don't know.
I don't have it planned too much from there. I know I want to go to Vietnam. A lot of my mentors are Vietnam veterans who became writers. Bruce Weigel and John Balaban and members of my own family who served in Vietnam as well. Some of my uncles. And I want to see what this place is and meet the people on the other side as well.
Well, you mentioned your mentors and your family, and you write in your blog, when you were growing up in California as a teen, it seemed the wonders of the world lay beyond the perimeter of the mountains circling your home, but also lay in the tales that your father used to tell or your grandfather used to tell of places where they'd been as soldiers.
When they spoke about it, they never spoke about war, actually. It was sort of the periphery of war, some of the exotic, interesting places that they'd seen. And they didn't actually talk about combat. I never heard anything along those lines until I came back from Iraq myself. Then some of those veterans in my family would talk to me about things they'd experienced.
Well, your father served in the Army as a Russian linguist during the Cold War. He told you about flying to an island, the Aniwetok Atoll in the Pacific Ocean.
He basically would fly from there down to in an arc over the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia and fly in this like a Cold War kind of mission to Tokyo and then back again. That was sort of the flight pattern.
What kinds of stories did he tell you about that island?
He told me stories like, for example, one of the times there was a small swimming pool on the atoll, and he went out there when they were off, and he jumped in the pool late at night. All the guys were egging him on, like, jump in the pool. And he got in there and realized that something very large and quick had just gone past him in the water, and it scared the bejesus out of him. So he jumped out of the pool, looked in, and it was actually a large sea turtle that they had put into the pool.
And your grandfather talked of islands with headhunters?
Yeah. He was a Marine infantryman, fought in most of the battles of the Pacific. I guess they call it theater. I think it's the wrong word, but most of the battles of that part of the war.
Well, and so what stories do you want to tell?
The stories that I want to tell are not my own. As I go, I'm just trying to learn, and that's why I don't really have a set itinerary. Exactly. I know I'm going to Vietnam, but that's a launching point towards where I don't know. And really, I just want to learn from people, particularly in places where there have been wars, which is pretty much anywhere on the planet. I'd like to learn from the civilian's point of view what things were like for them.
Well, and you do bring it back, though, to troops you might know because of your experiences. For instance, you traveled to see the Imperial War Museum in London, a lot of glass cases and closing exhibits, and it reminded you of Dallas Airport and the glass walls that troops go through coming home from war. Tell us more about that.
Well, as I was walking through the Imperial War Museum, I did see these figures dressed in different military uniforms for the period that they were in and what type of service they were in, and it somehow imagistically rhymed or echoed with my own experience of coming back. I was granted leave while I was in Iraq during 2004, and I came home for about 15 days. And when I went through the Dallas airport, it's a beautiful airport, and the people are very friendly. And at the same time, there was an odd feeling of being sort of like a museum piece. And as I walked through, I didn't feel at home, though I was at home.
Well, and, you know, as a non-soldier, you know, the reader might realize too, yeah, that is true. When I see someone in their full fatigues and their boots walking through the airport, I look at them, and you give me this whole new way of thinking about it, that you, that soldier, might feel like a specimen.
Yeah, and I would like to tack on a side story to that. That is, when I went through that airport, I sat down and had a meal. I got up to pay for my meal, and someone had anonymously paid for it for me. And so that's something I try to do now when I travel through airports.
Well, getting back to this trip that you're on, this adventure that you're on, Why Greece, by the way?
From the Greeks, I feel that there is an inheritance in Western civilization that is handed down through the literature, particularly in regards to my own experience as a soldier, but there's a warrior ethos, and I want to learn more about it. And I think if I'm here in the landscape, I can see the Acropolis and walk through some of the hills and go along the shores, maybe I'll get a sense of it.
Well, one of the things that you've learned is that there's something in the warrior ethos that we haven't adapted, and that's the idea of reentry. You write about, I think it was in Homer, how the returning warrior was stopped on the outskirts of town and sort of had some sort of ritual, which, as you write, you know, you speak about just suddenly landing at Dallas Airport. We don't have that anymore.
Right. The military, to give them credit, the American military is trying to do this. For example, they go to Kuwait, and I remember there was a building they had for, it's called Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Building, and they did a good thing there where they'd have you take your boots off, so you had to walk in on the carpet. There was a little bit of carpet inside. That was the first carpet that I'd really felt for a year, and I know this is such a simple thing, but it felt sort of like civilization. There are a lot of different briefings to try to help us understand what the processes that we'll be going through. But I don't think there's really a ritual that incorporates the civilian part as well. Do you know what I mean? Because as the warrior coming back, I think civilians need to somehow be a part of the process as well.
Well, and up in Maine, there are elderly veterans who are at all hours of the night will greet returning veterans. But help me explain this, because I think there was a Homeric reference to rituals that helped troops and warriors reenter civilization, but there's also one in Vietnam that you talk about.
Yes. The warrior class, when they came back from battle, oftentimes they had to stop short of the city or the village, and the villagers would come out to meet them, and there was a cleansing ritual. In doing this New York Times Home Fires blog, we found that I've seen a lot of responses talking about the Lakota Sioux and different Native American tribes who've also have similar types of ceremonies.
That's Army vet and poet Brian Turner. He's the Amy Lowell Traveling Poetry Scholar. As we said, he's in Greece right now. You can read some of his poems at our website, hereandnow.org, and you might want to do that while we take a minute break. We're going to come back and find out how the trip that Brian is on now will help him finally come home. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to our conversation with Iraq War veteran and poet Brian Turner. He's the Amy Lowell Traveling Poetry Scholar, which means that they are paying for him to spend a year traveling outside of North America. His award-winning book of poetry about his experience in Iraq is called Here, Bullet. He also contributes to the Home Fires blog on the New York Times website. There are links to both book and blog at our website, hereandnow.org. And so far on his travels, he's been to London, Rome. He's planning to visit Vietnam and joins us from Athens, Greece. And Brian, just before the break, we were talking about how other cultures, like Vietnam's, have rituals for returning veterans, even cleansing ceremonies. that helped the warrior re-enter society. And I was just wondering if this trip you're on now is giving you what you didn't get when you came home from Iraq. Nobody's fault, just the times that we live in. One day you're in the jungle, and as you say, the next day you're in your mother's living room. So is this trip giving you a slower way to return home?
Yeah, I don't mean to be cheesy, but the old Tom Waits song where it talks about how you never saw the moonlight until, never noticed the moonlight until you saw it on her breast, that kind of thing. We're basically, sometimes when we leave home, we learn more about it than when we are there. And I think that rings true. As I'm going along these travels, I'm sort of comparing home with where I am and trying to learn how people live here, and also thinking back to how people live at home and how I live at home, and what should I keep and what might I consider adding to my lifestyle back home.
Well, we understand as part of your trip, before you get home, you want to find your old translator in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yes.
Do you have a clue? I mean...
Well, I know he lives in Gradačac, and his name's Hanzi, but I don't know his last name. I only knew him ever as Hanzi. We were in the northern, my unit, the 10th Mountain Division. We were there from 99 to 2000, and he was getting up in years, so he may be gone now. I don't know if he's still alive, but... And I'd still like to meet his sons. He had a son who was a history professor in Sarajevo. And I know that if I go to Gradačac, which is a smaller town up north, that I should be able to find his family or someone who knows him and work from there.
Yeah. That's Brian Turner. He's the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholar, which means he has a year to travel abroad anywhere outside of North America. He's currently in Athens, Greece. And Brian, we love following your posts on your blog at the New York Times Home Fires blog, but also we look forward to the poetry that comes from this trip.
I do too. I look forward to the entire year, and it's an honor to be on here. The only thing I would add, if it somehow fits into the conversation, I used to play the trumpet when I was a boy, and part of the reason I'm going to Vietnam is because as I was learning trumpet in Fresno, California, in the San Joaquin Valley, a Vietnam veteran, Ray Ramos, who worked with my dad, he would come out to the house and help me learn how to play the trumpet. I didn't learn until recently that the bugle he played at veterans' functions, he would play taps all the time, was the same bugle that he had taken basically from a fierce firefight in Vietnam from a North Vietnamese soldier, bugler. And when I became a teen on Memorial Day and Veterans Day, and also during different funerals, I also played taps at military funerals and these events. So I kind of want to go back to where Ray was and see more about that land as well.
Huh.
I don't know if that makes any sense, maybe find something.
It makes a lot.
Sure.
It makes a circle. Brian, best of luck on your journey, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
And just quick note, the Vietnam War veteran we just heard Brian Turner speak of, Ray Ramos, the man who taught him how to play the bugle, well, Ray Ramos will be playing taps again today with that bugle as part of the Veterans Day Parade in Fresno, California. And we want to close today with a story from another vet in his own words.
This is the best way to put this. What got me through Iraq was I had convinced myself that I was definitely going to die. I was definitely not going to make it. That kind of freed me a little bit. And I realized that as long as I kind of had nothing to lose in that sense, then I was free. My name is Matthew Richard McHugh. My job started out as rifleman, and then I was promoted to team leader. The only thing I wanted to be in the world was a sergeant. Couldn't imagine being anything else. I'd have dreams about it. I imagined being a soldier forever. My squad was the night patrol squad. We would do an 8-hour patrol, and sometimes we would patrol till the sun came up. We would be in a kind of circle facing this market, looking at these farmers' markets, you know, and it was really incredible to see how much power farmers really have. And that was like a big lesson for me, that when everything else breaks down, the farmers really hold society together. I definitely saw how powerful the farmers were, more powerful than any other piece of infrastructure, more powerful than the police. And so I really started seeing value in agriculture. But so eventually I came back from Iraq, and I was very shook up, and I was had to train these soldiers under me, these new soldiers. And I was so affected by the situation that I was definitely going crazy. I really was going nuts. We'd go on a field problem, go do this, and then I would listen to these like peace albums by A Perfect Circle. As I walk on through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity. And I decided it was time to leave the army. There's something else going on. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? And that's when I looked up sustainable agriculture. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
And yeah, so the corn is getting a little bit more like corn, like, you know, real corn.
We are at the French Garden Farm outside of Sebastopol, California.
We probably won't plant here next year. It's just too much. I can't manage all this. but I'm really happy with these eggplants. Jeez, man, these things are rocking. They are rocking.
Favorite vegetables, rainbow carrots. I like chard. Definitely like harvesting onions because they're kind of your pride, you know. And potatoes. Absolutely enjoy potatoes. I'll do tons of potatoes next year. Farming is everything. You have to, just like soldiering, 24 hours a day, you don't stop. You are on the job all the time. You're always thinking about it. It just becomes a part of you. I tell people that I was from New Mexico, but then I tell people that I spent time in Iraq, and I'm no longer from New Mexico. I'm a person who's from war, and I think some people look at me as being from hell. I'm no longer afraid of Iraq, maybe the way I was. I think for a while I went through a time when I was simply afraid of the place. Now I do want to go back, but not as a soldier. I'd like to go back as a farmer. I still want to contribute to our society. I still want to make a world a better place. And I understand that having the power of soil is the most incredible thing on earth. Because you have that, you have the power to grow things. I think that I can do the world a lot more good with a shovel than I can with an M16.